Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 731. My name is Camden Busey. I'm here in Grays Lake, Illinois, back in the studio after some holiday travel. And I'm really excited to get back into the swing of things. And it's that time of year again here. Since 2008, I've been taking a beat around New Year's Day to bring you some of the top moments from the preceding year. And we have a bunch of great clips lined up for you today. And just a reminder, we have chapter markers that are embedded in the audio podcast, the MP3. So if your app supports it, the Apple Podcasts app, Pocket Casts, other apps, if they're worth anything, they should support the chapter markers that you can jump around. And the YouTube version as well has chapter markers embedded in the description so you can click among the different chapters or skip back and forth. So you could skip around to the best clips if you'd like and bounce around among them. You don't have to listen to me, but please do. If you would like to skip around, that's fine, but just wait a moment. I'd like to begin just with a bit of a year-end review. I'm really encouraged by what we have going on at Reformed Forum. 2021 was really big for us, even bigger than 2020. I just began working full-time at Reformed Forum in the middle of 2019. Took a while to get some things up to speed, but I've been encouraged by the way things have gone. 2020 was exciting, our first full year, and we brought Ryan Noah on board sometime into 2021 to help part-time with some of our efforts. But the Lord continues to bless our organization, continues to bless our labors as we're striving to support the church. And I'm greatly encouraged by what we've been able to do with the Lord's help and with his prompting. And I'm looking forward to what we might do next year. Now, we've made really significant progress toward our goal. We're putting our hands to the plow, so to speak. And though things are difficult and strenuous at times, we do this labor with great joy and with tremendous warm and full hearts. So thank you for making it all worthwhile. All of our listeners and viewers are so encouraging. Whenever I get out and meet people or when people write in, we're tremendously blessed just to know that the things that we do here are being used to your spiritual benefit by God's grace. I'm excited about that. We see that in the metrics. I mean, people aren't numbers, and we don't run everything by the metrics, but the metrics, the stats, the analytics, whatever you want to call them, are helpful indicators, at least to know whether the things we're doing are worthwhile. And this year, we continue to develop Reformed Academy, which is our online learning platform. Everything there is free, completely free, and available, reformedforum.org/academy. This year, we doubled our student base just over last year. So now that we have more than 3,800 people in 73 countries, it's hard for me to even get my head around that. But that number, the 3,800 students, is more than double what we had at the end of 2020. And these are real life people. These aren't bots or just people, fake taking classes or anything like that. They log in with a username and password and take the courses. These are brothers and sisters in Christ who are taking on-demand courses in Reformed theology. And many of their churches as well are using these resources in study groups and in Sunday school courses. Perhaps your church is doing that as well. If not, I'd encourage you to consider doing that. We have a lot of courses that are suitable for adult Sunday school, and we're actively working to develop many more. And we've got a lot in store, a lot planned for 2022. We're really getting close to securing a new facility. I'm really excited about that. Working on the details, legal details, financial details, all that kind of stuff, getting the place situated, working on modifications, negotiating all this stuff. So hopefully we'll be able to move into a new place early on next year where we'll have plenty of room for permanent studios and even a classroom setting where we can film new video courses with students on site. We're looking to labor and publish books and study guides that would accompany each of these courses. It's my heart's desire that we would regularly have people in to teach, where students as well can come from wherever they want to come. It's very accessible, easy to get to Chicago. This new place would only be maybe about half an hour from O'Hare if it all works out. So keep us in prayer that, things would work out. And we would like to get this thing working, this kind of like a flywheel, get it spinning and getting the momentum going so that every few months we get a course taught, we get books published that go along with the course, and of course that we have each of these courses, the video and all of the accompanying materials translated, and the videos subtitled into languages that are in use where we have established relationships with Reformed missionaries and with indigenous churches. Now, we've been very blessed to see our resources used heavily, especially in Latin America and South America. Down in Colombia, I visited just back in August and was able to meet with people that have been taking our courses. And we know we have students in China. I believe have all of our resources in Chinese and Spanish, and we're looking to expand with new resources, new courses, and new languages where we have established relationships. I mean, over the last 2 years, we've had many wonderful opportunities, but just frankly, not enough people and not enough time in the day to complete the projects that are before us. You see, sometimes I walk in and just see a mountain of metaphorical work, a metaphorical mountain of work. And you just wonder, how, Lord, are we going to do this? And these are good things, things we want to do, people, things that people want us to do, things that we would love to do, things that would be beneficial, fruitful, I believe, for the church, and helpful. And while we've really grown significantly in terms of our reach, we really need to mature in terms of our ministry staff and in terms of our infrastructure. I've been burdened, and it's been a joy, but frankly, just to pour out my heart a little bit, I've been trying to do everything myself. And having Ryan Noah help out has been a great blessing. Having our board help out, having many volunteers help out has been immensely helpful and a joy. But we're in a position now where we're just going through some growing pains, and they're good. It's encouraging. You want to have those. And I'm excited about this coming year. And I am delighted to say that we're actively working to bring some people on board to head up some of these efforts, to help with the courses, to help with the publishing, to help with our event planning and that sort of stuff. But frankly, we just need your help as well as we work through these growing pains. So this is my appeal, my pitch to you, and just as a brother in Christ, encouraging you to consider supporting us prayerfully. Really need your prayers. And thank you for doing that. But we also need and could use your financial assistance if you have the means, have the interest, and would like to come alongside us financially. It's very easy to do. We've got a new platform and a new a donor portal. It should make it easier for you to contribute. So visit us online at reformedforum.org/donate to pledge your support, maybe a one-time gift or a recurring gift of any frequency and of any amount. We encourage you to do that. And all of those monies go towards a good cause, good efforts here at Reform Forum. Of course, we're a 501c3 organization. All of your gifts are, at least in the United States, are tax deductible to the fullest extent allowed by law. And we'd be happy to talk to you about giving and any details that you may require by calling us up or sending us an email. Well, that brings us now to the fun part. This has been fun. It's been encouraging. Thank you for hearing me out and letting me unburden my heart a little bit upon you. But let's get into some fun clips from 2021. We've got 10 clips. I would like to do these in a countdown, 10, 9, 8, 7, etc. But you already see the list. You have a table of contents before you, and you could skip back and forth. So we're going to go in order, top clip down to the number 10. These are only determined by clips that were published in 2021, and they are determined by a number of YouTube views this year. So this is entirely objective. There's no value judgment to say that this one's better than that one or this guest is better than that guest. It's purely just pulling the stats from YouTube and then listing them here. You can see the power of the headline, and you can, when you start looking at how YouTube works and what people are searching for, you can see, I think, why these clips are the way they are in terms of the breakdown. Regardless, they're all excellent, spectacular. We're glad we did these interviews, and we're happy to share them with you. You can, of course, go watch the full episode or the full interview. You can also listen to or download for each of these, but we're just listing clips that range anywhere from 4 to maybe 10 minutes, and we've got a bonus clip at the end. But let's get into the first one, number 689, episode 689. We had Christopher Watkin on to speak about Michel Foucault. And our top clip of the year is speaking with Dr. Watkin on Foucault, on sexuality and identity. I'd love for you to unfold or unpack even more specifically the Foucault's notions of sexual ethics and specifically identity, even in general. There's so much to be said here, but where does Foucault begin, and how does he develop this throughout his later writings?
Yes. Prepare to forget everything you thought you knew about identity.
Yeah, you are not even you.
Everything you thought history was is wrong. Everything you thought power was is wrong. And so lo and behold, everything you thought about identity is about to be overturned, according to Foucault. So he starts off with this idea that we have of Victorian sexuality. And if I mention the term Victorian sexuality, most people think, oh, terribly repressive. We don't talk about sex. We pretend it's not there. He calls that the repressive hypothesis. And he says that that is 180 degrees wrong. What actually happened, he says, in the Victorian period, is that there was what he calls a discursive explosion. There was a proliferation of language about sex. And he particularly focuses on four groups of people about whom language was invented in this period, he says. Mm. We've got the hysterical woman, the masturbating child, the perverse adult, and the Malthusian couple. Right. And he says that what happened during this period is that these groups needed regulating in society. And in order to do that, you need a language to speak about them. So languages were developed to talk about these groups in order that they might be regulated in society. He's got this lovely crisp quote from the first volume of His History of Sexuality. He says, "It was time for these figures, scarcely noticed in the past, to step forward and speak, to make the difficult confession of who they were." And this idea of confession, which he gets from Catholic Christianity, is central to Foucault's idea of identity and sexuality. So he says that the Catholic Church predominantly developed this idea of confession that is speaking your deepest desires, taking what is most fundamentally you, if you like, what is really deep down in you, and vocalizing that. And he says that that has transformed itself into the paradigm of our society. He says we live in a confessing society. So, you know, back in the day, people used to do it to the priest. He says, well, now we do it to the psychoanalyst. Now we do it on television talk shows. This idea of speaking your identity, of confessing who you are, he says, characterizes our society. It doesn't simply register something that was there all along, but it actually constructs for Foucault the identity. So you become who you are in talking about it. There's an active role to this confession.
That is very prescient. We see that all the more. I mean, if ever he was right about or putting his finger on something in society, maybe that's it.
Yeah, I think it's incredibly productive as a thought. And how about this? He takes this idea of confessing who you are, and he says that that is what is happening in coming out stories, for example, when you're constructing your identity in terms of a particular sexuality. But here's a quotation that I came across years ago that's really, really resonated for me and I think is incredibly helpful in understanding both Foucault and contemporary society. And I'll just read it out. He says, "We expect our intelligibility, so our understanding of who we are, to come from what for many centuries was thought of as madness." And he's talking about what today we construct as sexuality. He says, "Our identity comes from what was perceived back in the day as a nameless urge. Hence," he says, "the importance we ascribe to it, the reverential fear with which we surround it, the care we take to know it And this was the key sentence that really leapt off the page and slapped me between the eyes when I first read it. Hence, he says, the fact that over the centuries, it has become more important to us than our soul.
Hmm.
So what he's saying is, we used to have this idea of that the very deepest me, the inviolable me, is my soul.
Right, right.
And of course, we as a society don't really believe that anymore. We don't think we have a soul, broadly speaking.
No.
But that's left a bit of a gap. So what is the deepest me, that the inviolable heart of me? And Foucault is arguing here that what stepped into that gap is what today we construct as our sexuality. That is taking the place that the soul used to take in our understanding of identity. And I just think that's incredibly helpful, because it helps to explain and it helps us to appreciate the huge emotional investment that there is in discourse around sexuality, and the way in which it generates very heated debate very quickly. And I think if we think of sexuality in terms of that is what people understand to be their soul, it becomes easier to see why the debate is so heated around it.
Well, our second clip is actually from the same episode. So he sweeps. He gets number one and two, the same episode, the same guest, takes gold and silver. We have Christopher Watkins speaking on Foucault on power.
Thing to get our heads around is that power isn't just one thing for Foucault. So when we think of power in society, we probably think of the government or the police, you know, top-down power dictating to people what they can do and what they can't do and locking them up in prison if they don't do the right thing, that sort of thing. For Foucault, that's only one sort of power, and it's probably not the most interesting sort of power. He calls that sovereign power. And he says that was the primary type of power up until about the 17th century. So you had this monarch at the top of society, and the monarch basically could say, I'm going to make you now fight in my army. I'm going to take your taxes away from you. I'm going to exert that sort of sovereign power over you. But basically, the monarch left you alone unless he or she needed you for your body in the army or for your taxes. And he says what happened is, as we get into the modern age, there's a new sort of power, a subtler sort of power that emerges in society, and he calls it disciplinary power.
Mm-hmm.
And he says its paradigm is the military parade ground. So before this period, armies were just mobs, basically, that rampaged around and didn't have a great deal of training. But now people realize that efficiency is the key to military victory. If you can load and fire a musket quicker than the enemy, there's a good chance you're going to beat them. And if you're more organized than the enemy, there's a good chance you're going to beat them. And so you start drilling very precise movements on the military parade ground. Everybody stands exactly the same. Everybody moves at exactly the same time. And you refine and make efficient, as efficient as you can, all those movements. And he says that idea of disciplining the body and of regulating its movements actually filters out into the whole of society. And so you get a very regimented timekeeping regime that comes in this period as well. And you have schools where the body is disciplined as well. You sit down at the same time, you stand up at the same time, you only speak when you're spoken to. And this idea of disciplinary power is much more, he calls it capillary. You imagine thousands and thousands of little capillaries in the body. It's not one huge artery coming down from the monarch, but it's lots of institutions in society, all disciplining your body, essentially, in particular ways to make it more efficient. And so the value of efficiency comes through very strongly at this period. And then later on, you get the idea of biopower, as you mentioned earlier, coming in, which is a much more, a much stronger sense of allowing someone to live until and unless that becomes inefficient for society. And so the control in each of these steps becomes more, if you like, invasive. It might look less spectacular, you know, so the monarch torturing people because they're seditious or whatever is very dramatic. But the monarch leaves you alone for most of your life. Mm-hmm. That was the sovereign power. In disciplinary power, it starts to become much more what you do in your everyday life is controlled and is subject to power and subject to what Foucault calls normalization. You're made to conform to the norm. And then biopower again is even more intrusive. So Foucault says it looks like we're freer than we've ever been in society. But actually, power is much more insidious now and gets into our bones much more now than it has done in the past.
In episode number 695, we spoke with Bruce Pass about his published dissertation on Hermann Bavinck. And here's a clip in which Dr. Pass speaks about Bavinck and superlapsarianism.
So at one level, the answer is very simple. He notes, he basically follows Calvin, that we simply have no warrant to speculate on, Christology anyway, kind of thing, incarnation anyway. Mm. The scriptures tell us that Christ came to redeem sinners and that the necessity of the incarnation is governed by redemption. In other words, Jesus comes in order to save sinners, yet everything, every fiber of Bavinck's being is pointing in a supralapsarian direction. So we have this flat rejection, that you just can't say this, but the whole structure of his thought is thoroughly supralapsarian. That this can be traced out in lots of different inferences and also necessary corollaries or entailments of his positions. So it creates this kind of tension, an interesting tension in his thought that he denies this and you're not allowed to say it. But a great deal of his thinking points in this direction. And I guess one of the interesting things, Edwin von Driel published a book on supralapsarian Christologies where he looks at, I think from memory, Schleiermacher, Barth and Dorner. And one of the interesting things is the influence of Dorner on Bavinck's theology. So I believe he was given a copy of Dorner's big Christology book as a gift from a congregation. And this source, one of the things I show is that a lot of the things Bavinck says, it's not attributed to Dorner's book. But if you look up Dorner's book, this is where he gets it from, even the language. Like you can trace the words, the expressions. So it's an area of research that's waiting to be done on the relationship between Dorner and Bavinck, particularly in the doctrine of God, because these phrases like modes of being, which become famous in readership of Karl Barth, they derive from Bavinck and Dorner. So Bavinck uses this term. It's less visible in the English translation of Reformed Dogmatics. It's not actually given in those frames, in those very words. But even in Dutch, Bestaansweisen actually is not immediately as close to Seinsweisen, but it's there. And both Bavinck and Barth are following Dorner, as well as Dorner's idea of absolute personality is something which crops up again in both Bavinck and Barth. So the relationship in which both of these thinkers stand to Dorner is something that's really worth thinking about, particularly in this supralapsarian impulse in much of Bavinck's thinking.
In episode number 706, I had a good time speaking with Jim Cassidy just after I had attended the PCA General Assembly, and we were chit-chatting about a variety of things, but we got to talking about and comparing the PCA and the OPC General Assemblies. In terms of the polity I know and my experience at a General Assembly, which has been Orthodox Presbyterian Church Assemblies, it was a kind of a wake-up call. It was a bit jarring in a sense, and I'm not saying good or bad. It's just surprising and took me a while to kind of gain my footing.
Yeah. Yeah, it is overwhelming, and I remember attending one of the General Assemblies, as I mentioned earlier, and being quite in awe of just the size of the room, I didn't know that hotels had rooms that big.
I know.
It was just chair after chair after chair, commissioner after commissioner after commissioner. There were so many people. It was so busy and et cetera. It was quite overwhelming. I mean, that's fine. It's glorious to see the church represented in such numbers when they sing, and the sheer magnitude of the volume that is produced by the singing mm-hmm. in their worship parts yeah. is incredible to behold. And I myself, though, am the type of person, I think, that tends more towards the small and intimate. And so an OPCGA for me has always kind of fit very comfortably. I do like the way in which we have extended deliberation. We are a deliberative body as an assembly in the OPC, where we have long, sometimes unnecessarily drawn out debate on the floor of the OPC General Assembly about all the matters that come before us. And so, but I like that because I sense that there is a iron sharpening iron thing going on in those debates. Sometimes the debate will go on for an hour and I won't have decided how I'm going to vote. I won't gain clarity on the issue right up to the 59th minute of the debate It just goes on so long and the issues are so intricate that sometimes it just takes me all of that time to hear both sides before I feel as if I can really make a good conscious decision about the matter that is before us. And mm-hmm. one of the unfortunate side effects from my perspective, not speaking objectively here, but from my perspective, one of the unfortunate effects of having a larger assembly, there are many benefits to it, many glorious and good things about it. But one of the unfortunate side effects from my perspective is a lack of that extended, drawn out debate. What happens is they have very close restrictions in terms of time for debate. Oftentimes that little bit of time that is assigned gets mitigated by way of somebody moving the previous question. And almost every time that I have seen, just watching GA assemblies online, when the previous question is called, it passes and they move and they stop debate and they move immediately to a vote. Whereas it's just the opposite in the OPCGA. Oh, yes. Almost every time that the previous question is called, that motion fails,
right,
and the debate continues going on. So that's one of those differences that is very jarring, very glaring when you attend the different assemblies. And I'm more partial to the iron sharpening iron, long drawn out, debates that are well debated. I mean, obviously you get those debates at OPCGA where you just kind of go, gosh, I think that same thing has been said by three different men,
I know,
six different times. I mean, and then the debate is no longer particularly helpful at that point. But when the debate is good and healthy, there's nothing quite like it. It's very, very useful for me.
In our fifth clip, Benjamin Glad was speaking about his book, From Adam and Israel to the Church. And in this segment, we speak about Israel and dispensationalism. Even there, we see the blessing coming to the nations. And then we have passages like Galatians 3:29, Romans 9 through 11, all of that, Romans 4, connection to Abraham is just somewhat lost. On classic dispensationalists, thankfully, it seems that as time moves on, there's been more of a shift where there's more of a convergence upon more biblical, theological, and reformed type ecclesiology, but it's going to take some time.
You know, with the death knell of dispensationalism, it's the use of the old and the new.
Yeah.
We have made great strides. Greg Beale is a pioneer. He really is a pioneer. He's one of probably four guys that pioneered that field. And the results of their work is the death knell of dispensationalism, because it can't hold up to the use of the old and the new. Can't hold up. It cannot take the blows. Mm-hmm. And we will witness. And I think so. Tim LaHaye died, what, like 5 years ago, 6 years ago, something like that. That's a symbolic death. It really is. And I, you know, there will always be a remnant, you know, to get back to Romans 9:11. There will always be a remnant of dispensationalists, but I don't think it will never enjoy, I think, the favor. And so what you have then is you have the decline of dispensationalism. And then coinciding with that, it's sort of the, you know, one kingdom falls and the other one rises. So what happened is now the resurgence of Calvinism among a younger group, and you guys may even be part of that. I don't know, but a younger group, people through the ministries of John Piper and ironically John MacArthur.
So you
really have this young, youthful desire to now read the Bible as a whole. And so now what they're looking for, because they're more Baptists, what they're now looking for is an alternative, hence progressive covenantalism. Do you see? So that's really, because they don't want to go full on reform, big R. They want to go reform, little r. So they have now produced an alternative to dispensationalism. Mm-hmm. You see, that tries to be more robust.
Yeah.
And when it comes to the use of the old and the new.
Yeah.
It's really fascinating. I wish somebody would, I'm not a historian, so I'm not the guy, but I would be fascinated for somebody to map all of this out, because it has unfolded before our eyes the last 15 years.
In episode number 712, we had Van Til Group number 5, installment number 5. Van Til Group is where Lane Tipton, Carlton Wynn, and I discuss and work through Van Til's book, The Defense of the Faith. And now in our 6th clip, Carlton speaks about natural theology, experience, and reason.
It is shown that the doctrine of God, A, is not taken from a natural theology worked up from experience or reason apart from Scripture. We can dive into that. B, that it therefore includes all the attributes of God, his personality and his Trinity. And C, that it is self-consciously set in opposition to all forms of non-Christian thought which compromise or deny the self-contained character by thinking of him or it as correlative to the universe. Okay, maybe the one that we want to draw out from those three things, doctrine of God, attributes of God, and set in opposition to all forms of correlativism, let's just go with letter A here. The doctrine of God is not taken from a natural theology worked up from experience or reason apart from Scripture. And experience and reason in that line are both in quotes. Lane, what's he getting at here?
Well, in summary terms, he's reminding us that the doctrine of God is not taken from a specific conception of natural theology. Now, he's not denying general or natural revelation, and he's not denying a natural knowledge of God. He's denying a certain species of it.
Amen.
And for Thomas Aquinas and the Roman Catholic tradition, the natural knowledge of God is not concreated in Adam as the image of God. For Thomas and for Rome, and he's very clear on this, Adam has the natural capacity to know God because he can. Because it was concreated. But in order for natural knowledge of God to be attained, Adam would have to use his reason properly, reasoning from natural effects to a supernatural cause. And if he used that concreated capacity properly, he could acquire the natural knowledge of God. That is, if he reasoned from his experience, from effects, to a natural effects, to a supernatural cause, then he could attain or acquire that natural knowledge of God. But for Van Til, following Calvin and Voss, the natural knowledge of God was concreated in Adam before the fall and remains after the fall, so that from the very outset, Adam could not only use his reason to learn new things about God, but the knowledge of God was gifted by way of being created in Adam. Think of the traditional Reformed description of the image of God. True righteousness, holiness, and what? Knowledge. Knowledge gifted. Knowledge concreated. And so the entire environment for Adam, according to Van Til, is it, whether it's internal in man as the image of God, whether it's external in the created world, it communicated the knowledge of God in a bond of natural religious fellowship that expressed itself in worship. And so when Van Til's talking about our doctrine of God not being something derived or taken from natural theology, worked up from experience or reason, he's simply saying this: we are Calvinists and not Thomists when it comes to our conception of natural knowledge of God. Natural knowledge of God is concreated and gifted, per Calvin and Voss, not acquired through a proper exercise of reason. For Thomas, the only thing that's concreated is the natural capacity to come to know God. For Van Til, it's both natural capacity and knowledge of God concreated. And so it'd be very easy for our listeners to read this and say, oh, there Van Til goes denying natural knowledge of God. Not at all. He's actually denying a Roman Catholic conception. And as we read him more fully in other places, he's got a much more robust view of the natural knowledge of God and a fuller orbed conception of natural theology than the Roman Catholics.
In episode number 699, G.K. Beale and Ben Glad joined us to speak in this segment about inaugurated eschatology.
Those basic movements from Adam to Israel as corporate Adam to Jesus as true Adam, doing what the first Adam and Israel as corporate Adam should have done. And in Ben's book that you interviewed him on, what's the title of your book, Ben?
From Adam and Israel to the Church.
Yeah. Yes. Right there in the back.
It's a nice summary of all that we have in our story retold. And one thing we haven't mentioned yet, I think that we should, is that another way that the old is related to the new that we talk about, especially in the introduction to the book, and then we develop it later, is this already and not yet eschatology, that the end times have begun, but they're not completed. And when you go to the Old Testament, it's very interesting. If you do a word study of the phrase in the latter days, in similar phrases and synonymous phrases, what you find is there's no inaugurated eschatology. It's all prophesying about the future. And then the New Testament takes those same phrases and will say something like Acts 2:17, in the latter days, God has poured forth his spirit. Or in 1 Corinthians 10, the consummation, the end of the ages has come upon us. Or 1 John 2:18, it is the last hour, and so on. And so you have this amazing movement. And Voss points this out. He alerted me to this a long, long, long time ago in a little bitty chapter in his book, Pauline Eschatology, where he summarizes this. It's beautiful. That's very crucial. And what's very interesting is in the Old Testament, sometimes it looks like those Old Testament prophecies earlier are being fulfilled later. For example, prophecies of the temple. So when the temple is torn down, it's prophesied it'll be rebuilt. They come back after exile. It begins to get rebuilt. But it's so pathetic that the people remembering the first temple cry. And it dissipates. Finally, in 70 AD, it's destroyed. So it looks like there's fulfillment, but there's not. True fulfillment is when a fulfillment begins and it cannot be reversed. That's true fulfillment. And so that's why when Christ comes, what he inaugurates, even though it's not consummated, what he inaugurates is a permanent beginning that will therefore surely be completed. That's why, for example, and this is a very subordinate point on soteriology, that's why if we've begun to be regenerated, that regeneration, which is resurrection life, will be completed. That's why we believe in the perseverance of the saints.
Yeah, Philippians 1:6.
Of the saints because of eschatology. It cannot be reversed. People need to learn their eschatology, then they will become Calvinists.
I'm with you.
And Camden, look on page, if you have the book in front of you, look on page 14 and on page 17, So one of the difficulties in writing a book like this, right? Yeah, the very nice graphics that IVP did. And then on page 17 as well, mm-hmm. we tried to do these inaugurated eschatology graphics. And Greg and I went round and around. And I bet you I emailed them 70 to 100 times just on those things, wow. just going back and forth with the designers to make sure we get the stuff right and the right labels. And there's a reason why there are not many, if I don't know if you've thought about this, but there are not many graphics depicting inaugurated eschatology well, and it's because it's hard to do. Well, we really tried to do it. So we have it on page 14 and on page 17, and right. then we do it really throughout the book mm-hmm. and apply the different subjects as we encounter them. And we use this, we keep going back to this paradigm. And I think it's a really unique thing about the volume that we're trying to graphically demonstrate what's taking place in the New Testament and even today.
Yeah, I was impressed when I saw those graphics and how well they're done, but also, you know, conveying something that's rather difficult to convey. But so many of us, I'm not really exclusively a good graphical learner, other people are, but it's so helpful, especially in the context of a classroom, for people to see this. And they just, you can see what these kinds of things when they finally get it through a visual, how their eyes light up and they just, it clicks.
Right. Like to just
go graphics ahead. Are hard to do. I don't mm-hmm. know how many doctoral dissertations I've looked at that even by my students or by as an external reader, and they try to do a graphic and I can never understand it.
Yeah. Right.
Because it's in the guy's mind.
Right.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
I just can't understand it. And, so these were very, very hard. I hope I understand them now. I think I do.
But like, for example, on and page 17, we show how the Old Testament views eschatology. Basically, it's the bad stuff comes first, the stuff in the red. So you have tribulation, false teaching, suffering, and then you have new creation. Then you have kingdom, which then eventually culminates in the new, we call it the new eternal cosmos there. But what happens in the New Testament, Jesus says, I'm telling you a mystery. And in this particular text, he's talking here about the mystery of the kingdom, how you can have the establishment of the eternal kingdom and tribulation overlapping. The two ages are now, the new and the old are now overlapping. And it was difficult. I mean, it was difficult for the disciples to really grasp this, as it is. In fact, it's not a coincidence that almost every New Testament text, every New Testament book keeps coming back to this paradigm. The new is here and the old is here. The new yeah. is here and false teaching. They keep rotating around these two ideas because I think it's just hard for people to grasp that reality.
I mean, how many people really believe in the church, including Reformed Christians, that the Great Tribulation has begun? I think most even Reformed Christians think that is ahead of us. The New Testament writers believe the Great Tribulation had begun. 1 John 2:18, my little children, it is the last hour. And I tell you that you have heard that Antichrist is coming. I tell you many Antichrists have already come. From yep. this we know it is the last hour. Well, that's saying that the Antichrist is here. It goes on in the following context. It talks about the Antichrist who is here. So unbelievable. If the Antichrist is here, then the Great Tribulation has begun, but he's here in mystery form. He's not here incarnately. He is here in his spirit. So there's a mirror image. You have Christ who produces his spirit throughout the church age. With the Antichrist, he comes at the end of the age. He's incarnate, but sends his spirit back into the age. It pervades the present age.
For episode number 713, I was all the way out in Maine. I was attending the OPC's Ministerial Training Institute, where John Mather was teaching a course on OPC history. And after that course was finished, I was able to sit down with Danny Olinger and John Mather. We got to talking about the Committee of Nine and all sorts of interesting early OPC things. So shout out to PresbyCast, and you can blow the Machen horn at the moment. But in this moment, we got speaking about premillennialism among Presbyterian fundamentalists. I'm picking up a thread on Murray and Woolley, and you mentioned as premillennialism, not dispensationalist. He was historic premillennialist. But I've always, of late, have found this fascinating that Murray was writing this series of what did he say? There were issues or problems with the fundamentalist,
the Reformed faith, and its modern substitutes.
Modern substitutes, right? And one of which is premillennialism, specifically dispensationalist, but still other forms of premillennialism too. I'm curious how Woolley would have interpreted these critiques from his own faculty colleague.
Well, I think he got along great with Murray and respected his exegesis, mm-hmm. but that same independent streak that. Woolley did not mind being the sole voice in a boat. It didn't bother him to be the sole historic pre-mill on the faculty. But I thought he had a very, very good relationship with Murray. And that's one thing that, my mentor, Charlie Dennis, when I came into the OPC, I would see Charlie on the floor of a presbytery meeting or general assembly really debating hard. Really aggressive and hard, and then having great fellowship with the very individuals that he had just debated hard. That's the sense I get that Woolley was not offended and really showed what I think John's on. It was very correct in regard to he's really the embodiment of the American Presbyterian antecedent in its best form, and much like a Warfield form or a Hodge form, but in the courage of his convictions. But he was so erudite too. He was good friends with Gerhardus Voss, and I think part of that was the tremendous book learning, just widely read on so many different subjects. And so conversant, and so I think he's just the type of guy. I think when Machen found Woolley, it's like he knew he had gotten a treasure that was going to give everything he had to the institution, and also being a churchman to the church. And so Woolley's it's a 50-year service that was probably most appreciated by those who knew how much lifting he was doing behind the scenes. He was never seeking out the spotlight.
And back to the dispensational issue, this was an issue early in the life of the OPC, Westminster Seminary, and in Woolley's career. It comes back again at the very end of Woolley's career. Yes. The very last General Assembly he attends and where he votes is the 1975 assembly that is voting on a union with the RPCES, which in some respects was a reuniting with these premillennialist elements that had left the OPC in 1937. And Woolley believed that there were still some unresolved issues there that made it premature to unite. And so he cast his vote against that vote, even though it would have meant bringing in those of some greater theological affinity with him.
He was the only, so there was probably 5 to 6 Westminster Seminary faculty, OPC ministers who were at that assembly, and he's the only one who votes against the merger. The rest of the faculty votes for the merger. Yeah. That's the amazing thing about Woolley is that one would think the modifications that the RPCES would make for eschatological liberty, that Woolley, if thinking his own view might gain greater acceptance, he still confessionally thought it was a bad thing to do, and both wrote about it and voted against it. And it's interesting, an ally he had in that was Meredith Klein. And Meredith Klein, at the same time, was writing articles about premillennialism and amillennialism, and it was attacking very fiercely the sense that to do this was so to make this compromise, to allow this, was so contrary to the eschatology of the Bible that the Reformed faith should think about this very seriously. It's when he was writing those articles on Revelation 20 and the first resurrection in the journal.
Our ninth clip of the day we have from episode number 709, a fun episode that we took on listener questions. Ryan Noah, Jeff Waddington, and I were answering stuff from the mailbag, and Jeff got talking about Thomas, Van Til, and classical theism. It seems to me on the whole that there's a tendency to equate classic theism with Thomas, since he's such a giant that you just assume that if we want to maintain immutability, aseity, all of these classic doctrines of Christian orthodoxy, and Thomas has been known as such a giant and critical defender of these things, it's easy to elide those two together, to use Thomas as sort of a metonymy. You know, he ends up being like a synecdoche for orthodoxy, or at least traditional orthodoxy, which we reject. Now, there's a lot of excellent argumentation in Thomas, but I think also his metaphysics, his Trinitarian theology, certain things, it has some weaknesses and some issues. And I think a lot of Reformed Thomists, if there is, you know, if that's possible, but there are Reformed people, confessing people that, you know, would still call themselves Thomas, I think they're falling short on their appreciation of Thomas because they're not seeing his true genius in his entire system and how it all fits together. And people want to pull out his doctrine of God while rejecting his sacramentology or rejecting the doctrine of the beatific vision and the self-communication of God, participation in God to the fullest extent, such that it ends up in some form of divinization, not by subsistence, but by participation. And people say, well, we don't like that, but we appreciate his metaphysics here, his essentialism and his doctrine of God, which upholds orthodoxy. Well, my opinion is you're selling Thomas short because he's way more brilliant and intelligent and has a much more developed system than you are giving him credit for. He cannot be taken piecemeal. He's thought this through, and his metaphysics is thoroughly throughout the entire system, and they're necessary entailments of that system. Exactly. So the other thing is that people don't like Van Til, I think, because they haven't spent time to understand what Van Til is actually saying. Now, I know people get upset and they say, well, all the Van Tilians always say that no one ever understands Van Til. Well, maybe that's Van Til's fault. All right. But let's give him credit. I think the problem with why that story persists throughout the ages and sadly is getting worse, at least for the moment, and we're trying to combat this, is because there have been poor interpreters of Van Til, people that have understood Van Til on some points, but then when it comes to the doctrine of God, have compromised immutability, aseity, simplicity, these other things. And to name names, we've named them before, Dr. Oliphant and Dr. Frame have not helped the Van Tilian cause on this point at all. They do not, at the end of the day, understand what Van Til meant by the self-contained ontological trinity. And that, to me, is the whole crux of the matter. We follow Van Til here at Reformed Forum insofar as he is following after Calvin. And Calvin was so keen on the autotheos of the Son, the fact that the Son does not receive his divinity as a derivation from the Father. You know, the Son is begotten, and his personality, in a sense, is communicated, but not his essence. And the same for the Holy Spirit. They're autotheos, and when we understand those, that the Son is rightfully and directly God himself, same with the Spirit, and that the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit relate to one another perfectly and exhaustively through perichoresis, as developed by Van Til, as developed by Bavinck, and many others before them. I think that's a much better and much more robust and sustainable doctrine of God that does hold to the Orthodox and Catholic notions, small c Catholic notions, of simplicity, immutability, aseity, without the fault lines that we find in Thomas Aquinas. There's a lot more to be said, but I would say that's the big issue and the distinction between what our faculty here at Reformed Forum are presenting as a Van Tilian Catholic orthodoxy versus what other interpreters of Van Til have presented as tending toward modernistic views or modernist views of the doctrine of God, which I do not think represent Van Til faithfully.
No, it's if you read Van Til, as you've already said, Kent, and his reference to the self-contained ontological Trinity is itself overthrown by mutualism, what our brother James Dalzell has called theological mutualism.
In our 10th clip, we pull from episode number 696 with Crawford Gribben. We had just a really great, fun conversation talking about one of his recent books. And in this segment, Dr. Gribben speaks about Christian Reconstruction and the religious right.
Yeah, well, of course, the moral majority was never the majority it was thought to be, was it? And
that's the evangelicals' problem, isn't it? They always round up too much, I think.
Absolutely, round numbers. I think Rushdoony would never have been fooled by that. I think Rushdoony was pretty clear that the number of people who were prepared to endorse what had to be done to live faithfully, for the church to live faithfully, was always going to be a remnant. You know, and you know, the language of the remnant is language that floats through his writing in I think very considerable degrees. I think it's an interesting question, Camden, the question about how influential Reconstruction ideas were on broader evangelicalism. In a way, we could say hardly influential at all, because, you know, the story of 1970s into the 1980s, the Christian Coalition, moral majority, that story is the story of an attempted power grab.
Yeah,
right. A top-down effort at national reformation. We get our man into the White House, Pat Robertson, wherever it's going to be, you know, and he'll do what we want. So, you know, they get, you know, 76, Jimmy Carter outs himself as an evangelical, raises lots of completely unfounded expectations as to what he's going to do, for example, about Roe v. Wade. Then they transfer their, you know, all of their utopian, almost millennial hopes into Ronald Reagan. What happens? The same thing all over again. Different party, but the same kind of political experience. So, you know, all of these efforts to achieve Christian Reformation through top-down implementation of power fails again, again, and again. Meanwhile, you've got Rushdoony, Chalcedon Foundation, toiling away quietly in California, you know, producing rafts of publications. Gary North doing the same. You know, little communities springing up, collapsing, all over different parts of especially the southern states. But some of their ideas then begin to creep out and to permeate into some really unusual places. Now, Julie Ingersoll, in her book Christian Reconstruction, writes about this, I think, really well. And she describes how, you know, in some of the lobbying organizations in Washington, you know, there are shelves of Reconstructionist books sitting there ready to be used. I remember back in the late 1990s, when I was, you know, collecting a lot of this material, I found in another secondhand bookshop in Scotland a copy of one of Gary North's books about economics, which had inside it a bookplate that said it had belonged, or perhaps even maybe it still did belong, to the Royal Bank of Scotland. I have no idea how books get in, you know, a bank collection into a secondhand bookshop. But anyway, you know, there it was, and I've still got it. So, you know, Gary North's books, you know, in the Royal Bank of Scotland, other books in lobbying organisations. But really, you know, Reconstructionist ideas do begin to make an impact on evangelicalism through Francis Schaeffer. And Francis Schaeffer has a relationship with R.J. Rushdoony's work that is difficult to be precise about. But there is certainly, I mean, there are certainly chunks of Rushdoony that appear in Schaeffer's work. Now, in some ways, that's ironic, because Schaeffer wasn't post-millennial, he was pre-millennial, and than Rushdoony ever was. Rushdoony, in his Christian Manifesto, the need for Christian citizens to resist the state from time to time, Rushdoony doesn't go down that route at all. He's much more interested in retreating in order to survive, instead of trying to conquer America by military force. And, you know, I suppose one thing you could say that Rushdoony was trying to teach American evangelicals that they might not have been listening to, was that the transformation of the individual through regeneration has to come before the transformation of families, of localities, of counties, of states and then ultimately federal government itself. But the Reconstructionist vision is very much bottom up in the 80s. I think probably also to the present.
Well, those are all of our 10 major clips. We hope you enjoyed them, but I'm going to bring you a bonus because in 2021, we also published a very special bonus episode where Lane Tipton and I sat down and recorded an homage to one of my favorite TV shows. I guess it's not really a TV show, but one of my favorite video programs. You can find it on YouTube. It's called Hot Ones. Lane and I sat down and ate 10 increasingly spicy hot wings with the actual hot sauces from one of the seasons of the show. I think it was season 13. We bought these hot sauces. We went and ran through the entire gamut. And it was quite, I don't even know the right word, but it was an experience. So I'm going to share with you a clip or two, some of the best moments of that episode as well. Enjoy, laugh. And now, just so that you know, it has become a thing where I receive hot sauce as gifts. I received a hot sauce just a couple days ago in response to that episode. When I went and visited my parents, somebody had given my parents a hot sauce to give to me. Thank you. You know who you are. I appreciate it. It tastes great. But I also, one time was doing pulpit supply. And you know how after the sermon or after the service, often the pulpit supply person or the pastor will come and stand at the back door while everyone's walking out, and you can greet people that way. So I was greeting everyone, saying hello, and a very nice couple also gave me the bomb. They came and brought to me a hot sauce. So that's the first time ever that I'd received hot sauce as a gift at church in a receiving line after a service. So I'm not encouraging that. I'm just saying it happened. Thank you very much. And all I'm saying is this episode where Dr. Tipton and I eat chicken wings with crazy, insane, spicy hot sauce on them has become something of a cultural meme and a recurring feature now of my daily life. And such it is. So here's a clip from Reform Forum's Hot Ones. Reform Theology Meets Spicy Wings. Now we're up the bomb. This is a bad memory right here.
This is an hysterical memory as well.
There's no common grace in the bomb. Oh, that's bad. That is so bad. Oh, there, I remember this. Oh. All right. So Cornelius Van Til is very famous and well-known for speaking about God as one person and three persons.
Yeah.
What did he mean by that, and how does his polemical context add further explanatory or further illumination on what he meant?
For Van Til, God as one person is synonymous with what Bavinck said about God as absolute personality. That God in his unity has one mind, one will, one consciousness, he's self-determined. Yet, as Bavinck said, that absolute personality unfolds itself in a threefold subsistence of Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And all Van Til's trying to do when he's using absolute person language is use it synonymously with absolute personality. His context, the polemical context, Van Til thought it was very important to speak this way because, among other people, Gordon Clark argued that God in his unity is mute substance, and that as mute substance, this is in a different stratosphere.
This is so rough. The bomb is just it's terrible. Hideous.
That as mute substance, personality is located only in the hypostases as discrete bundles of thought. And so Van Til thought that was heretical, at risk tritheism, which I think it does. And so he was wanting to say that God is absolute in his personality in a way that accords with full orb Trinitarianism. Gordon Clark denied that. And I think the secret, if you really want to try to understand Van Til on absolute person and absolute personality, is that he's trying to explicate and advance the thought of Bavinck in particular. Okay, I got to take a.
You should call this like King Ahab and Jezebel's, you know.
Yeah, I got to say something. That stuff right there, you don't mind me saying this, I want to retain decorum, is the most foul-tasting, offensive thing I've ever put in my mouth. That right there, the bomb. It is so close to the intrusion of a judgment
that's
that removes all grace.
As it gets.
It's hideous. That's terrible.
Are you understanding now my reaction last
goodness,
time and how
yes.
much is that stuff I put out of that piece
goodness,
of steak?
Goodness, yes. And when you layered it up, I don't know how you did it. Here's the thing. Here's
breathing
the
hurts. When you breathe, the vapors just come out and eat your
throat.
This
makes whatever else we're going to do.
Yeah.
Extremely difficult.
I think that's the sneaky thing of hot ones, that number eight, the bomb, is actually the worst. And I don't think it's that it just cauterizes your face.
Wow.
I think it just masks everything that's to come.
And then we're pouring sweat. Yeah. Look at that. Goodness gracious. Okay?
That is so bad.
Well, thanks so much for watching the clips. Just again, It's really fun to review and to see the things that we've been able to do for the last year. Again, I know I've said it already, but I've been greatly encouraged. A few more things just to mention, and a bit of a prospect, for the year to come, because we hope to meet and connect with many of you. And we did. Back in Pflugerville, Texas, back in October, we hosted our annual theology conference. Because of COVID restrictions and all sorts of things, because I live in a state where we'll just be diplomatic and say they are exceedingly cautious in terms of the efforts to prevent the spread of the coronavirus. We hosted our annual conference in Providence OPC in Pflugerville, Texas, and we covered the Covenant of Works. Just as a sidebar, those addresses are currently being developed into a book. Maybe we'll be able to finish that in 2022. We're looking forward to that. So we have a lot of books in the works. That's one of them. But we are making every effort to host our annual conference in Grays Lake, Illinois at Hope OPC once again this year. It's been 2 years since we've been there and some change, and we're looking forward to getting back, if at all possible. We're doing our best. We're going to make it happen. Well, we plan to host that conference in the fall, and this year we will focus on the work of Meredith G. Klein. But in addition to our own conferences, we also continue to travel, continue to exhibit at other events. I'm scheduled to go down and teach with the OPC Foreign Missions once again in Colombia in January. So please pray that we'll still be able to do that, that the travel restrictions won't be in effect, and that I continue and everyone else continues to remain healthy so that we can do this work. And if we're not able to do it in January, that we're able to do it sometime later in the year. We are planning to attend the annual Greenville Conference again in March. We also plan to connect with many of you at the PCA and OPC General Assemblies this summer. So if you're planning to be at those, come look us up. Come find us, meet us, and we'll talk. I'd love to meet you. I'd love to encourage you in your walk in the Lord, and to be mutually encouraged, I should say, in our striving to meet him when he returns. So until then, just to conclude, please, you know, consider supporting Reform Forum, not because we seek to be an end in ourselves, but so that we can continue supporting the church in presenting every person mature in Christ. That's our mission statement from Colossians 1:28. And we got a lot going on. And if you're encouraged by the things that I've been able to mention and report on, then come alongside us. Visit us online at reformedforum.org/donate. Have a great new year. Continue to seek after Christ in all things. Thanks so much. I hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.